Welcome to Local Motion, KVNF's weekly public affairs program. I'm Jody Peterson. Our western slope forests are more than just a beautiful backdrop. The aspen, spruce, fir, and other trees across our region provide a home for birds, big game, and other wildlife. They provide timber for building and firewood. They hold soil in place and prevent erosion. And they filter rainwater and snowmelt flowing into streams and rivers. But our forests are in trouble. You've no doubt noticed that in parts of the western slope, aspens have died out and conifers have turned reddish brown. To find out what's affecting our forests, I spoke with forestry experts from Colorado State University and the U.S. Forest Service. For the big picture, I turned to Dr. Jason Seibold, a biogeographer and geography professor at Colorado State University. He's been studying forest health for more than 20 years. I asked Jason what's causing the problems we see with so many trees dying off.
You know, we think of them as problems because they're altering these landscapes that we've known for so long and that have been relatively stable for a long period of time, certainly for our lifetimes, and probably our parents and grandparents. So we see a lot of change going on. We have some drought that's killing junipers, spruce beetle killing spruce trees, western balsam bark beetle killing subalpine fir, a whole host of beetles attacking other trees. And then, of course, there are fires that have been happening. And this past year, we saw a very large avalanche cycle, and we lost a lot of forest through avalanches. And then, of course, we have sudden aspen decline, which the general kind of root cause of that is drought. So we see a lot of dramatic change. I know right now it's kind of ratcheting up into fourth gear in your landscape and in around where you are.
But this isn't something that's just happened over the past few years, is it? Can you talk a bit about what's led up to the current situation?
This began back when we started to have some pretty severe droughts in 2000, 2002, 2003. And we just have gotten into this cycle where every 2 or 3 years we're having a fairly severe drought, and we are just seeing the effects of that, sometimes directly with drought killing trees through moisture stress. So that's a lot of the sudden aspen decline, that the aspen just can't deal with the drought conditions. And this is also fueling large beetle populations, wildfires, all of these kind of massive changes that we're seeing these days. This past spring was very cool and wet, and the spring of 2015 was cool and wet. But if you take those 2 years out of the last 20 years, you know, we've just seen 2 decades now of pretty warm temperatures and oftentimes low precip, and that's driving all of these changes that we're seeing.
And how does climate change fit into this picture?
This is climate change. We are seeing climate change in our landscapes. That's driving beetles. Climate change is driving these forest diebacks that we see. All of these things are all associated with climate change. And the big thing that's happening right now with climate change in your region is that temperatures have been elevated. And when they're elevated, it's really exacerbating the drought stress that the vegetation's feeling. So when the trees don't have enough water to do all the things that they need to do and maintain the processes that need to occur in that tree, they're drought stressed. And then when it's warmer than normal, this stresses those trees even more. So it kind of ratchets up the pressure that that drought puts on these trees. So they can die just from the heat and water stress, and or if it doesn't kill them directly, it opens them up, it weakens them for things like bark beetles to attack them. At the same time, these warmer conditions and longer summers are really facilitating the development of large beetle populations. So the beetles absolutely love these hot temperatures and long summers.
So we've been talking a lot about insect outbreaks and how that's worsened by climate change. Can you talk about wildfire also? And what are we seeing in terms of changes in wildfire severity and frequency, and what's behind that?
Climate change is driving a lot of the uptick in fire that we're seeing. If we think about Colorado before the year 2000, the wildland fire community often referred to Colorado as the asbestos forest. Mm-hmm. And in particular, your region was super resistant to fire because by the time the snow melted out and things started to dry up, you would have a pulse of moisture coming in with the southwest monsoon in the middle of the summer. So in other words, things never had a chance to dry out. And then at the end of the summer, if the southwest monsoon starts to peter out, well, we all know that snow isn't all too far away. So things very rarely had a chance to dry out. Right now, what we see is springs are coming earlier and earlier. They're warmer. That snow melt-out date is earlier and earlier. So we're starting to see the emergence of pretty consistent fire season in Colorado. Of course, this summer, we didn't see that. We had very high snowpack, and it melted out very late, and then the southwest monsoon kicked in. So we haven't really had much of any fire activity this summer, which is great. It's a nice reprieve, but climate change is the primary driver of this. Warm, hot, drought conditions, earlier snow melt.
I understand we're also seeing more and more of a phenomenon called dust on snow. What is that, and how does it affect the snowpack?
Dust on snow is a really interesting thing that's impacting our snowpack and fire seasons. Oftentimes this happens when we have a storm that's approaching, you know, your area, kind of coming in over Arizona, Four Corners area, and it'll pick up a lot of that dust and push it up into the atmosphere. So when you actually have the snow fall, it incorporates a lot of that dust. So you will actually see at times these kind of snowfalls, and the snow will have an orange hue to it. So when the sun hits it directly, that snowpack is warming up and melting out much faster than it would if it was nice white snow, which is also moving up the date of snow melt and starting to dry out fuels. So we have dust on snow speeding up the melt out combined with climate change. Both of those things mean that in our summer season now, we do have enough time for fuels to dry out to the point that they'll burn. Why do we have so much dust on snow recently? Well, part of that's climate change. The southwest Four Corners is drying out, so we don't have as much vegetation holding those orange soils in place. The other factor is, of course, wildfires in Arizona and the Four Corners area that's removing vegetation and now not holding those soils in place. And recreation is also a part of this. So hikers, mountain bikers, ATVs, tearing up cryptobiotic crust, the crust that hold those soils in place. And also cows have done quite a bit of that damage, cows and sheep, by trampling the soils as well as through their grazing habits.
So what can forest managers do to help make forests more resilient to all of these changing conditions?
So in terms of how we might manage our forest landscapes to be more resilient or adapt to climate change, the biggest thing that we can do is start to acknowledge that we have all of these changes happening right now. And one strategy that we oftentimes immediately want to go towards is what's called a resistance strategy, that we want to stop these things. We want to stop the beetles. We want to stop this change that we see going on all around us. And in reality, that's probably not really possible. And I think the other thing to keep in mind is that all of these processes that are happening are natural processes. And we know now very well when we start tinkering with natural processes like fire and we take them out of a system that's dependent on these things, usually the outcomes aren't great. We might not like them. We might not like the impacts that they have on our landscapes and our view sheds and our recreation and challenges that they create for safety and water management and things along those lines. But these are natural processes that our systems are adapted to. And it's very likely that these processes, if it's beetles or fire or whatever it is actually going to facilitate a transition in our forest landscape to a landscape that is more adapted or better adapted to current and future climate conditions.
And that was Jason Seibold of Colorado State University. I'm Jody Peterson, and if you've just tuned in, today on Local Motion, we're talking about the state of our forests on the Western Slope. I also talked to Mike Battaglia with the U.S. Forest Service Rocky Mountain Research Station. I asked him the same question I'd asked Jason Seibold. What can we do?
Increasing resiliency of forests to climate change and other disturbances is going to require a long-term view. Forests are very long-lived, so things that we do today have legacies into the future. For one thing, in the short term, you know, understanding the locations on the landscape that will be the most susceptible to future changes in temperature and moisture conditions can help land managers plan their forest management, you know, going into areas that are more at risk and doing something there to help favor a tree species that might be more adapted to a warmer condition, for instance.
And how do they tell which areas are more at risk from climate change?
There's definitely some things like topographically, if you think about a mountain with the southern exposure versus a northern exposure, they get different amounts of sunlight, they get different amount of moisture, and those things really govern whether a certain tree species will be growing there or not. And so if we know it's going to get warmer and drier, one thing they might want to do on a southern facing the slope is to carry less number of trees on that slope so that the trees are not competing as much with each other for moisture. Or they might change the species composition on a southern aspect versus a northern aspect to favor those species that can handle more droughty conditions or warmer temperatures.
But that sounds like a pretty intensive form of forest management if you're talking about actually managing the composition of species. How would a land management professional even go about doing that?
There's definitely different things they can do. They can use mechanical treatments, which is what we often think about with forestry in terms of removing trees. Another thing that they can use is prescribed fire, using wildfire, those kinds of things to get it in there earlier before it gets warmer and drier, so it's under more controlled conditions. And so certain trees are more resistant to fire than others, depending on the tree species. You know, in terms of the entire landscape, we're not going to be able to treat all the landscape, but we can help move it in the right direction in terms of their trajectories over time that would facilitate species that are more adapted to a warmer climate.
So is there anything else that forest managers can do to try to help our stressed and damaged forests?
Another thing that land managers can do is to provide more resources for the trees that are currently growing there. And so we know from our research that if you reduce the number of trees in a forest, then you can increase the availability of resources like moisture. So think about it like your garden. You know, you often plant more tomato seeds than you want plants. And you get, you know, 50 plants show up, you thin those out to the, you know, number that you want so that you can increase the chances for those tomato plants to produce tomatoes. And so it's kind of the same way with forests. We might have 1,000 trees out there, but we don't need 1,000 trees. So we'll thin those to a number that would allow those trees to grow, utilize the limited resources they have, and produce habitat or timber or whatever the goal is.
Is assisted migration something that is ever considered as a possible tool?
Assisted migration is an interesting topic. Assisted migration is either taking a species that doesn't grow in an area and moving it to that area because you know that the climatic conditions are going to be favorable for that species. Or it could even be as simple as taking a tree that already grows in an area, but getting seed from a different source, from an area that is more south or at a lower elevation, and using that to repopulate an area. There's a little bit of hesitation, obviously, to do that full scale, but it's one of those things that would, if we start doing that, it would be very good to do experimentally and with rigorous monitoring to see how these things are doing. I think experimentally it would be something that we might want to look into.
And so we were talking about tools that land managers can use. And I know one of the things the Forest Service has been doing is some logging contracts. And so how do those fit into the picture here?
So logging can help increase the resiliency of a forest because what it does is it takes away some of the overstory trees and makes room for new trees to establish. So oftentimes when we go and take a tree out for timber, we will leave some trees for the future seed source. Those seeds fall on the ground, the ground is open and ready to receive the seeds. So the seeds regenerate, and then you have a multi-age, multi-sized stand of trees. And that's important because in an uncertain future, we don't know if the bugs are going to come or the fire is going to come or drought's going to come. And having those different tree sizes increases the resiliency because of that diversity of sizes allows only certain trees to be susceptible to the disturbance that is going to challenge them.
So let's talk about scale. The Forest Service manages at least 11 million acres in Colorado, but what percentage of that land can it actually treat each year with thinning or logging or prescribed burns?
The amount of land that the Forest Service has that is in need of treatment is much larger than the amount that we can mechanically do ourselves. A lot of areas are too steep for us to do anything mechanically. A lot of areas are near people's homes. And so there's some limits to what we can do. So that's why it's important that when we do these treatments, we look at areas that we want to prioritize that are going to be the focus of our treatments to get the biggest bang for the buck. And we do that a lot to optimize our treatments to protect a certain watershed or protect a certain subdivision or protect a certain area that has a wildlife habitat. And so it's a lot of looking at your landscape, deciding how that fits into the treatments you've already done, how does that fit into wildfires that have already occurred, and things like that to piece it all together to make it come out in a way that is going to be more resilient in the long run than just going to areas and doing really small treatments all over the place.
You were talking about that in the context of mechanical treatments. What about prescribed burns?
You know, deciding where to prescribe fires is also a really important task to do. And they also prioritize areas based on watershed health and areas they need to protect from a wildfire coming through the area and where they can actually get more fire on the ground. In fact, a lot of places are starting to look at, you know, once we do treatments, can we allow fires to burn because the landscape is able to receive the fire? Mm-hmm. And so bugs and fire do more treatments than we could ever do mechanically. And so what we want to do is facilitate a landscape that can receive those kind of disturbances without getting the full negative outcomes of them. Because these fire and bugs are native to these ecosystems, and these systems were governed by them before we ever showed up. And so trying to get that kind of disturbance back onto the landscape in a way that seems acceptable to society is a really important thing that we're all working towards.
This is Local Motion on KVNF, and I'm Jody Peterson. We're discussing forest health today, and the man I was just talking to is Mike Battaglia of the U.S. Forest Service. To get a sense of how trees are faring in our local national forest, the Gunnison, Grand Mesa, and Uncompahgre, also called the GMUG, I spent a morning recently with several Forest Service staffers. We toured stands of aspen, spruce, and fir a few miles north of Paonia. Clay Spees, the Renewable Resources Staff Officer for the GMUG, gave me an overview.
To date, we've had well over 300,000 acres of spruce affected by a spruce beetle, and that continues. We still see beetle spread across many parts of the forest, and that continues at a rate of probably 30,000 acres annually. All the bigger trees are the ones that are most vulnerable, and those are the ones we're seeing that are dying because of the spruce beetles. And then on the sudden aspen decline front, we have about 230,000 acres been affected to date, but the stands that are affected by SAD continue to decline. There we're trying to regenerate younger, healthier stands.
So what is the Forest Service doing to combat these problems and try to make the forest healthier? I understand there's a program called the Spruce Beetle Epidemic and Aspen Decline Management Response. What's that about?
And what this project is an 8 to 10 year project. It's trying to treat as much as 60,000 acres commercially and another 60,000 acres non-commercially. Commercially meaning that we can get a product that could be sold at a local facility. And the whole idea was more rapid response to the spruce beetle epidemic and aspen decline. And the goals are to focus on, first of all, public safety, things like trees that are close to roads, infrastructure, utility corridors. It also was to focus on resiliency. Resiliency meaning we're trying to increase the diversity across the landscape of age classes. So we don't want all these older trees. We want to have, you know, babies, you know, middle school kids, teenagers, adults basically on the landscape. And that was another whole idea of the resiliency. And then the last goal was recovery. There's a lot of dead material out here in the landscape that could be utilized by local industry to produce things, goods and services that the public needs, such as 2x4s and 2x6s to build homes, that kind of thing. But also, as part of the recovery objective, we were restoring roads that have been out there on the landscape for a long time that we actually decommissioned as part of this project. We're replanting trees, and we wanted to bring the public along as we were going, and we also wanted to use best available science. Every year we have public field trips where we take the public out, show them what treatments we're planning and why we're planning those treatments. We also have a midwinter meeting where we invite the public to come and hear about what we're planning for the next 3 years. They can hear about the latest science and how that might be affecting our management.
And that was the Forest Service's Clay Spees. As we continued our tour of this part of the Gunnison, Grand Mesa, Uncompahgre National Forest in eastern Delta County, Paonia District Ranger Levi Broyles discussed the history of the region and what's happening today.
Between the late 1870s and about 1910, 1911, roughly 70% of the North Fork burned. Because there were some photographs taken in the 1880s through the 1910s, we can tell that what used to be on a lot of this landscape was mixed conifer. The fire is what opened the door of the more early Cyril stage aspen to replace the conifer that was here prior. And that's why 40% of the Paonia Ranger District is now covered with aspen.
We're up on Stevens Gulch Road.
Yep, we're looking west at the Terra Creek drainage. Almost exclusively aspen from what we're looking at. There are older aspen that you can see the trunks of that a lot of them don't have leaves at the top. And then there is a younger staged aspen. And those are areas that have been harvested in the past. That is the standard way to regenerate aspen. They are small patch clear cuts to allow the younger trees to come in and replace the older trees that are dying out.
If you didn't come in and clear cut those older aspen, then would the stands regenerate on their own?
Some of them would. What we're seeing right now across the forest is about half of our aspen stands are regenerating. Under sudden aspen decline conditions, the aspens that died out on their own, none of them regenerated. But under good climate conditions, we're guessing that about half of them would regenerate on their own. You can get substantially more than that if you come in before the older aspens die and take them out to release the understory aspens.
And can you talk a little bit about sudden aspen decline and what that is and how much it's affected trees out here on the western slope?
Sudden aspen decline, we think, started following the drought of 2002-2003. It weakened the trees and allowed a host of different pathogens to come in and attack the trees. We lost a lot of acres to sudden aspen decline, and they have slowly come back from that since we went back into a more normal precipitation regime following that. But it was something that had never been seen, to my knowledge, before.
I understand the Forest Service is actually hoping to put some of these dead aspen to use in a biomass plant in Gypsum.
We've been working with the cogenerating plant at Gypsum. They cogenerate heat and electricity, and to do that they need biomass, and they're not particularly selective on the type of biomass that they use. And so we're hoping that they will be able to come out and harvest and chip on site and haul the chips back to Gypsum and put them to a good use.
After Levi Broyles finished speaking, we continued our trek through the forest towards Overland Reservoir. At a stand of towering spruce, Kerry Johnson, a forester with the Paonia Ranger District, explained why some of the trees have bare upper branches.
So we're looking at a spruce stand that was harvested in 2002. And what they did was called a seed tree harvest. And that's where you leave overstory trees to allow seeding into the ground. You leave it fairly open so that there's room for the seed to establish and the new generation to start. And the problem that we found here is that we've had this budworm, it's spruce budworm, and we've had it here for about 5 years in a row. The caterpillar eat off the new growth of those trees. And typically it won't kill a mature tree. It will stress it, but it won't kill it. But these younger trees, if they get hit enough years in a row, it will kill the trees.
All this discussion about the various stresses that forests are facing, from beetles to heat and drought, got me wondering about what the future might hold. I asked Jason Seibold, the Colorado State University geography professor, what he thought.
Our future landscape is going to look a lot different than it does today, and it has looked for the last 100 years, or even, to tell you the truth, it's going to look a lot different than it's looked for the last few thousand years. We are moving towards in terms of climate, a totally new scenario. If we use the tree ring record as a reference and we go back to about the year 1300, we've only seen droughts of the severity of 2002 and 2017 on average about every 150 years. And we just had two within a 20-year time period. So these are really severe droughts that traditionally would have hit every 150 years or so. Now we have them once a decade. The projections of where we're going is that by the 2030s, it will be more frequent than once a decade. And the worst case kind of projection is that a 2002 high severity drought or 2017-18 high severity drought, which, to be clear, these were dry years and hot years, which is really stressful for vegetation for us. The worst case scenario projection is that becomes our average climate by the mid-2030s. So we are going to see a very large restructuring of our forest landscape. It's very hard to say exactly how everything is going to play out, but you can imagine forests that need wetter, cooler conditions like spruce fir or aspen are going to be greatly constrained in their extent. We're not going to see them in the same places that we're accustomed to seeing them.
So can trees eventually evolve and adapt to all these changes that you're describing?
The grand challenge for these forests is, can they migrate? Can they move? Can they adapt fast enough? We know that they have moved and adapted to vast shifts in climate in the past. We know that these trees can move around long distances on the landscape. The big concern right now is that the rate of warming that we've experienced and that we're projecting in the coming decades is much, much faster than anything that these trees have experienced coming out of a glacial period. So we just don't know if they're going to be able to track that.
So if we wind up losing a lot of the big trees that we're familiar with, what kind of landscape might replace them?
There are a lot of different potential outcomes, and each valley and slope and site will probably play out in unique ways. The general thinking is that spruce fir forests will have a hard time extending upslope because of a lack of soils and harsh windy conditions above tree line. So at the lower elevations, they will shrink. And then the species that are below them, let's say maybe Douglas fir and ponderosa pine and aspen, in theory, they should be able to move into those locations that have been vacated by spruce and fir. So they will move their distribution upslope and into these areas. At the same time, Douglas fir and ponderosa pine and aspen on their lower elevation extents, they will then start to lose their area at those lower elevations, and pinyon and juniper will move into those areas. So that's kind of the rosy outlook, is that everything will basically shift upslope. The other scenario is that we start to move more and more of our landscape towards grassland and shrubland, and that we're shifting this away from the potential of having forest and shifting this more towards grassland and shrubland. terms of management, there's only so much we can do. If we want to engineer these landscapes and help them adapt, there's so much uncertainty in terms of where it's going that we would have a hard time even saying, even if we had billions of dollars at our disposal, which we don't, you know, but even if it had billions of dollars, it would still be a tall task to say, okay, what exactly do we do? One thing that's kind of a logical way to go is to diversify our forests. As many different kind of scenarios as we can have on the landscape would be better. So age classes, density of trees, aspen mixed with spruce, aspen mixed with Douglas fir, Douglas fir mixed with spruce and fir. So the more heterogeneous that landscape is, the more likely that we're going to preserve seeds on the landscape, not lose everything in a single event, and try and maintain some of our species diversity and genetic diversity out there on the landscape.
And that wraps up this edition of Local Motion. You can find this program, plus much more, on our website, kvnf.org. Thanks for tuning in.